Speaker for the evening, Mike O. from Chula Vista.
My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Damien for asking me to come here and speak tonight. Got to get my name in great big green print here, like wide right here. You know, like I'm somebody special. Now I'm just a garden variety drunk, man. That's who I am. My sobriety date is June 24th, 1985. I just celebrated 30 years of not drinking. And I'm just about that close to my next one, and I know that. You know, I have a fatal disease, and I didn't have a clue what alcoholism was for a long, long time. I mean, I knew that I was an alcoholic. I mean, I just, the way I drank and some of the things that I would do and my behavior and the fact that I couldn't stop, that young lady talked about it perfectly. I have an allergy to alcohol. That's the main thing that separates me from most people out there in the real world. They don't crave alcohol when they drink it. They can stop anytime they want to. I cannot. The problem with me is I have a mind that doesn't always buy into that idea. I don't always believe it, you know. So my thing is I was driven here by the lash of alcohol. And I had my own first step experience. And I keep doing AA because I never want to drink again as long as I live, one day at a time, of course. And the problem with that is that I'm really not so sure I won't. This is a one day at a time deal for me. And I learned early on that the only thing that's going to come between me and taking a drink of alcohol is the power greater than myself. I didn't know any of that stuff when I first got sober. I'm going to tell you a little bit about, you know, what it was like with me before I ever took my first drink. I think it has some relevance. I don't think it's what made me an alcoholic. You know, like I said before, I could tell you I was alcoholic. I could go to meetings and voice it and, you know, like I really knew what it was, but I didn't have a clue what it meant to be an alcoholic until I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's when I finally came to the conclusion that I have this problem. You know, I have this obsession that drives me to drink against my will. I'm powerless over alcohol right here and right now that has not changed. And if it ever changes, you know, if I get somewhat unconvinced, it will come time to drink. And so I finally, in order for me to do the first step, it says in our literature that we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. And until I knew what it meant to be an alcoholic, I don't think I could have done that. I don't think I just could not have done that. And so I grew up in a household of six people, and out of six of us, four of us were alcoholics. And I'm not going to sit up here and say it's a genetic thing. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I don't think it's even relevant to know whether or not, well, it's a genetic thing. I was born with it. I mean, it's not going to change anything at all. I'm not going to be any less alcoholic just because it's a genetic thing. It doesn't even really matter. But what does matter is I have it. The big thing that I can tell you about who I was when I was a kid was fear. Oh, my God. I was riddled with fear. From the moment I opened up my eyes to the time I went to bed at night. And even when I went to bed at night, that's when the fear came in the most. Because everything got real quiet. And I was just left with this. And, you know, when everything's real quiet and I'm left with this all by myself, that's kind of a bad place to be. And I experienced that when I was a young kid way, way back when I was like 12, 13 years old. And, you know, I was so frightened that I used to, like, beg my brother to stay awake so I could go to sleep first. You know, and that's what it was. And you didn't tell my dad, you didn't walk up to my father and say, you know, Dad, you know, I'm having a real problem sleeping at night. I'm not quite sure what's going on here, but I'm frightened. I couldn't even identify an emotion or a feeling. And even for a long time in sobriety, the first 5 years, I couldn't identify a feeling or an emotion at all. And there's no way I could have done that. First, I didn't know what it was, and you didn't go talk to him about something like that. Because he was an Irish Catholic kind of guy, and you're brought up to, you know, to take care of yourself. You know, don't ever ask for help. That's a big one. That's an old idea that that booze finally surrendered, that I kind of supported for a long, long time, that you never, ever ask for help. You know, because there's too much risk involved in that. It makes you look bad, and, you know, it shows a sign of weakening, which is true. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's kind of a contradictory because I have to ask for help in order to not die from drinking. And I would like to tell you that I did that out of virtue, but that's not the case with me. Had nothing to do with any virtuous altruistic ideas at all. Booze forced me to surrender alcohol. And that's what happened with me. So I grew up in this household, and I was riddled with fear, and a lot of it had to do with I secretly and didn't even really know this because I couldn't tell the truth. I wanted my dad's approval. That's what I was really looking for. You know, I wanted him to give me some attention. I mean, I wanted him to come to the ball games like the other fathers did and watch me play baseball. And, you know, I just wanted some kind of recognition, a pat on the back from time to time and say, you know, good job, son. You know, I love you. And, you know, just like I seen other normal kids do. And I would get jealous of these kids and I would resent them because, you know, their fathers were there and mine wasn't. So to protect my ego and to not look bad, I would resent them and look down on them and judge them. And that idea stayed with me for a long, long time. So I grew up like that, and the biggest idea that came up with me, like from the very get-go, which is I'm not enough. That's the big idea right there that I supported all my entire life. I'm not enough, and I had proof of that because where's Dad? So somewhere along the line, I developed this belief. You know, that I'm inadequate, I'm not smart enough, I'm not good enough, you know, I'm just not enough. And you know, what that does for me, the kind of manifestation that comes from that for me is approval. And I'm scared to death I'm not going to get approval. And I'm terrified of disapproval. I just need your approval all the time. And didn't even know it. I just knew that there's something wasn't quite right on the inside of me. I couldn't put my finger on it, I couldn't own it. I couldn't tell the truth about it. I know it today, what it was today, and it was like some sort of a soul sickness. Way back when, before I ever took a drink of alcohol, I was like, I had a sick soul. Like this uneasiness on the inside of me was always there. It was like there was like fire going on the inside of me. And that's the way I was as far back as I can remember. So I found little ways to entertain myself. I like to destroy things and break windows and anything that I could do to get some kind of attention, pick on my brothers and sisters because they wouldn't give me any attention. And I mean, that's just kind of how I grew up like that and didn't know anything was really wrong. I just knew when I didn't get what I wanted, it was like I was a little kid on a high chair with a spoon, banging a spoon on the top of the high chair. Give me my way, give me my way, give me my way. And if I didn't get my way, I made sure that you paid for that. I mean, that's kind of how I grew up, extremely self-centered, selfish to the core. So this carried on for a long, long time with this whole household thing. And my dad died December 13th, 1971, one day after my birthday. He died drunk. He was an alcoholic. He died a hopeless drunk because he had too much pride to ask for help. And he'd go to these meetings, and this is a story I heard, and he'd sit around and he'd say, you know, I'm not like them people, and, you know, they have no willpower. They can't take care of themselves. I mean, it was that Irish Catholic backing, you know, those old ideas. And his pride basically killed him, coupled with alcohol, of course. And it was a sad thing, but, I mean, that's just the way it was. And so right after that, I had my first drink. And all that stuff that I just got done telling you about, basically all that dis-ease, that ill-at-easeness that I carried in my soul for a long time, just kind of an uptight, anxious kid that was always on the go, would just keep moving, go here, go there, because I could never be still in my own skin. Could never do that. 14 years old, I had my first drink. And what happened to me, it was like some sort of magical potion that I've been looking for years, like the first 10 years of my life, and didn't even know it. Because what I got out of that alcohol was exactly what Dr. Silkworth said that people like me get, which is a sense of ease and comfort. And I'm telling you, man, it only took about 4 or 5 beers to change the world that I lived in my own mind. It didn't really change anything. It just changed the view for a period of time. And, you know, as time went on, I continued to drink more and more and more. And, you know, I decided to join the Navy like at 17 years old and I couldn't stay in there long. And they frown on you when you don't show up for work. You know, they get pissed off about that and they put you in the brig. And so they got sick of my crap after about, you know, 6 months in the Navy and they booted my ass out because I couldn't show up for work. And I was a 17-year-old punk kid. I didn't know what I wanted. You know, alcohol was the number one most important thing in my life at that stage. I was a full-blown alcoholic at the age of 17 years old and didn't even know it. I just thought that I liked to drink, which I did. There's no doubt about that. And I didn't realize, it's not really that big of a deal when you go out and drink all night and you're taking, you know, wine to work and, you know, you're having problems with relationships. You can't hold down a job. You're having conflicts with the family. That's not that big of a deal. Everybody experiences that, right? They drink like that. And that's how I rationalized my alcoholism when I was young. And everybody does that, and really not that big of a deal. And then I started having some trouble, I met the first her when I was about 18 years old and somehow conned her into marrying me, and we stayed married for 9 years. You see, it takes about 6 or 8 beers for me to show up and to put on some kind of an image, like I've got it all together, to get you to buy into it. I'm a great actor. Our big book tells us we're like an actor, and I am an actor, believe me. Especially if there's something that I really want. I can be really good at it. And I know both ways to go about it. I can be kind, considerate, patient. If that doesn't work, I can be mean, egotistical, whatever the case needs for me to get my own way. And I just developed that way back when I was a kid. And you have to practice that to get good at that. And I got really good at that. And I got her to believe in me when I didn't believe in myself. And we got married, and we stayed married for 9 years. And the first couple of years, I think we had a pretty good marriage. I was showing up for work, trying to be a husband and had a kid come along and trying to be a father as best I can. But there was one thing that kept looming over me, and that was alcohol. I was a weekend warrior at the beginning, like back then. And I kind of felt like entitled, it's owed to me to go out and drink and race cars and race hell and not come home all night and never call the wife. And, that's pretty normal. Everybody does that, right? Everybody stays out all night and drinks all night. And as long as I was with a group of people, they kind of allowed me to self-justify that and rationalize that this is really all okay because they're all doing it. Can't be that big of a deal. And I used to think for a long, long time that my family members and everybody that always talked to me about my drinking were just really overreacting. They were making too much of a big deal out of this. Really isn't that big of an issue. You guys just need to let me do what I want to do, and who cares as long as I go to work, right? That's kind of how I operated. That was the belief system that I worked off of. It's amazing to me that the hell and the fear that I put this woman through for 9 years, and somehow she stayed with me for 9 years and put up with that. It was like a weekend thing with me. Was like, is he coming home? I haven't heard from him. Is he in a hospital? Is he dead? Nobody knows where he is. And it didn't even faze me in the least. I'd come crawling in sometimes at daybreak and kind of shut off the car motor so I could coast in the driveway with the hopes that I could get upstairs and get in bed without her knowing it, And she knew all the time. She just put up with me and she was just one of those dedicated women, man. There's not many of them around, and I pretty much just used her up, basically, because I'm a user. And so at one point, she... We would have these talks about my drinking, and we would bargain. I don't know if anybody's ever bargaining with their drinking with their spouse. Let's see. I think I can make it home at midnight tonight. Let's shoot for the goal of being home at midnight. And you know what? I really thought that I could do that. I really believed that I could stop anytime I want to, and be home when I said I was going to be home. And when the body sets off that phenomenon of craving, there's no going home for me. I'm not coming home. I need to continue drinking beyond the craving, beyond my mental control. There's no way that I'm going to stop drinking at midnight and come home. So we've seen that wasn't working very well. And, of course, it was traffic, and I had to help a friend. He had a flat tire. And there was somebody that was in a major emotional conflict, and I needed to be there. Any kind of lie that I could come up with, right, as to why I couldn't make it home, that like I said I could. And so we stretched it out to 2 o'clock in the morning. I said, maybe we can just work this thing out. Let's go to 2 o'clock in the morning. And so she got on board with that, and, of course, I agreed with it, and I could never live up to it. I couldn't live on. I mean, that's... That's like me trying to control and enjoy my drinking while drinking, and it never works, not even one time. Because when I take a drink of alcohol, I'm out of control, man. Absolutely, 100% out of control, and didn't even know it. I just thought I was having a good time. And I didn't know that I had the mind of a chronic alcoholic, that I had a fatal illness that was going to kill me. It was on a fast track, going to kill me. It just hadn't caught up with me yet. So at 9 years, she decided to get rid of me. She got smart and left me for my best friend, which was the best thing that she ever did. And I had a really hard time with that in the beginning, you know, big time resentment, my ego shattered, you know, it's making me look bad. How can she do this to a guy like me? Because I did show up for work as much as I could, and I just couldn't get it, you know, why she would do that, especially with my best friend of all people. I mean, what kind of a classless woman there would do something like that, right? And later on I found out and admitted that was the best thing that she ever did, was to get away from me. I had nothing for her. I wasn't present mentally, emotionally, in any shape, form, or fashion at all. And I didn't even know it. I didn't even have a clue. Because, see, in our literature, it says, to us, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And to me, it did. It's not, but it seemed that way. And that's how insidious this disease is. I just thought it was, again, everybody's overreacting, you know, and just all that bull crap. And so what I did was, I went out and got drunk one night, you know, the rejection, I can't take it, you know, I'm obsessed over her, I want her back. Everything that I'm doing these little chicken shit drive-bys and breaking out their car windows. And, you know, that's who I am. When I drink, I'm a little chicken shit coward, man. I can't face you on, I got to do everything behind your back. And part of me really enjoyed it because I was getting away with something. See, that's how I serve my ego. I'm getting away with something one more time. And, you know, I outsmarted them, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And they all knew that I was doing it. They all knew it. I got back one night at about 7 o'clock in the morning from driving all the way up to Victorville. It's 150 miles away from here with no driver's license. No driver. Drunk out of my mind. You know how important it is. You have to show them when they do something. You got your pride about yourself, so you have to show them, and I did. And they called me right when I got home. They said, "We know you did it." And I said, "What are you talking about?" Sheriff was here, and of course they knew I did it. And, you know, later on in the program, I had to make an amends for that, obviously. But what I did was, I think the point that I want to bring out is I tried to kill myself one night because I couldn't get her to come back to me. You know, I was so depressed, and alcoholism at this stage is progressively getting worse and worse and worse. And the depression and the despair and the remorse and the shame and the guilt was so overpowering that you need to have a universal plan for that, and that's booze to fix that. And I was so wrapped up in it, and I went out one night and tried to kill myself, and I thought maybe this will work, you know. Maybe if this will get her attention, this will show her how much I really want to be with her, and I'm going to be a regular kind of guy, and it's going to be different this time. And again, I didn't have a clue that I was dying from alcoholism. Not a clue. So I came out of this coma after about 3 days, and the psychiatrist standing by, and he's looking right at me, and you know, it's like I'm looking real pitiful, and I'm looking for help, and he asked me one question, and he says, "Mike, what would it take to make you happy?" And this is the best I could tell him. If I could just get my wife back, everything will be okay. You know, and that's how deluded I was. You talk about self-delusions. I mean, that's how deluded I was. I actually believed that if I could get her back, everything would be okay. I didn't have a clue that I had a fatal illness that was killing me. Not a clue. It didn't make any difference whether she was going to come back or not. That wasn't going to stop me from drinking. In fact, there's nothing going to stop me from drinking when it comes time to drink. If I don't have a higher power and if I haven't found a spiritual experience, I'm doomed. 100% doomed, and I know that today. And so that didn't work very well. So another couple of more years of destructive drinking, and I'm going to jails and institutions, and I'm trying to commit suicide. You know, the loneliness and the separation from life, and the knowing that you're basically a loser, way deep down in the core of your being, as far down as it would go, man, became so overbearing that I didn't see any way out of this dilemma. I couldn't stop drinking. I'm miserable. My life is just nothing. I'm alone, you know, and I'm just a loser. And that's kind of a scary place when you finally come to grips, briefly, of course, that things are really that bad. And I would go to meetings. I'd go to AA, you know, because my ass was on fire. I'd crawl out of jail one more time or county mental health, and I'd show up at these meetings. And I remember thinking about not drinking. And, you know, not drinking kind of stuck with me as an idea for a period of time. I didn't stay sober. It just stuck with me as an idea until it came time to drink again. And that's what I was doing in the early 80s. You know, going in and out of jails and institutions and hospitals and suicide attempts and just everybody talking to me about my drink and trying to get me to see what's going on here. And I can't see it because I can't differentiate the truth from the false. I can't. I cannot see it. I thought everybody was overreacting. And so what happened with me was finally June 24th of 85, I received a gift. And I'm going to tell you right here and right now, my sobriety is a flat-ass gift. I can't buy this. I can't read enough books to get it. I can't have the right sponsor to get it. It's a flat-ass gift. And what happened to me June 24th of 85, the gift that showed up in my life is called surrender. Now, I would like to sit up here and tell you that I decided to go to AA on a Saturday morning because I think I'm going to get in trouble, but that wasn't it. That had nothing to do with it at all, because I'd done that before, and I didn't stay sober. So when I got locked up in the San Diego County Jail June 24th of 85, I was absolutely 100% hopeless. And I'll tell you something, the reason why I keep doing AA and doing what I'm doing now, because I want to stay hopeless. Coming to meetings and doing AA keeps me hopeless. I like that. It keeps me on the move. It keeps me moving along with the steps in the program and working with others and service work because I'm hopeless. I'm a hopeless drunk. And there's something that happened to me in the San Diego County Jail. I was separated from alcohol, more than I ever had before. I was locked up for about 100 days, these drunk driving tickets. I got booked in there as a transient. I mean, I had nothing. I was zero in every category and area of my life. I was hopeless and helpless, and I knew it for the first time in my life. And I finally admitted complete defeat, and I didn't even know I'd done that. That's the gift. That is the gift. See, when I talk about my surrender, and anybody that's been sober for any period of time has a story about surrender. And my surrender goes like this. I got locked up in the San Diego County Jail, and I realized for the first time in my life I was going to die from drinking. My life was absolutely unmanageable. I couldn't hold down a job. I didn't get along with people. I just didn't mix well. I'm completely maladjusted to life. I just can't seem to adjust to my surroundings at all. And I was hopeless and helpless, and booze made it so. Alcohol. So what happened was, is out of us just having some kind of brief moment of clarity about my condition and how serious this thing really is, I just said, "Dear God, help." It's probably the most sincerest prayer I ever said in my entire life, and it had nothing to do with virtue at all, not in my case. I just said, "Dear God, help." I didn't know any prayers. I was brought up as a Catholic. I knew that there was a God. I didn't have much use for God. He was some kind of inconvenient. You know, I didn't really want to spend the time to even think about God because, you know, when you're a big shot and you're, you know, important and entitled like I am, I mean, why would you want to think about God, right? Time for that. But this time I was really sincere with my prayer. And what happened with me is somehow God got in there and surrendered me. That's it. God kind of got in there between my pride and my ego and all my self-reliance and everything that I thought I knew about life and everything else and slipped right in there without my consent and surrendered me. That's it. That's the deal. That's what happened with me. And I didn't know it. I didn't know it for a long, long time. So I stayed in there, and there was a lady who used to come up and do H&I, and she knew something about this institution. She said, would you like to go here? And I said, sure, where else am I going to go? And I went to this place called Pathfinders, and I was there for about 7 months. And I was fortunate enough to be around guys in AA back then that talked a lot about not drinking. I know today it's somewhat underrated, but I talked, and they talked a lot about not drinking, going to meetings and steps and helping others and service work. And I'm still a real big believer on that not drinking part. It really fits in there with this whole program, is that not drinking. And I'll tell you something, you know, when my ass has been falling off in AA, even after I've been sober for a long time, and I think that's when I kind of fall on that basic training, which is what I was taught in AA from the very beginning. And again, that's that not drinking part. And so I'm a big believer in that, and that's what was impressed upon me when I was new. So these guys would show up at these meetings, and they were sober for a long time, and, you know, I desperately needed their approval. That idea or that belief was still following me with Dad, and I was, you know, fear would manifest itself in its own way with, you know, I'm scared to death and not getting your approval. So how it would manifest is I was a little chicken shit people pleaser. You know, that's how fear manifested in my life, because of this fear of disapproval. And so, you know, I would, you know, rub up against you, kind of get near you, or act as if I wanted to be here. But I was really terrified of you. And I'll tell you the reason why I was scared to death of these guys is because I knew they knew who I was. I knew they could see right through me, man. I knew that they knew that I was a little phony, chicken shit liar, and I was a loser. And I knew they knew that, man. So what I would do to protect my ego, of course, because I don't want to look bad, from time to time, I would, like, not make eye contact with some of these guys. I would avoid them. Sometimes I'd want to be around them and get their attention, but for the most part, I would avoid them because I knew. I knew they knew who I was. And so what happened with me is, and I knew they were serious about not drinking, too. They were really serious about that. And they were really serious about steps. They would come up to you and say, what step are you on? You know, how many meetings are you going to? Are you working with others? Or you doing service work? They were just really big on all that stuff. And, you know, so what I did was, because I heard everybody else doing it, I just finally walked up to a guy and asked him to be my sponsor. And that's where it all started with me. So he told me to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I read it. And the more that thing I read, the first couple of years, first 4 or 5 years I was sober, I think I was in that, like, that know-it-all stage, and there's only one way, just no open-mindedness to anything else at all, except for, you know, the big book and the steps, which is all true, it's still true today, but my mind has opened up to other spiritual aspects of my life as well, but in way back when, it really wasn't like that at all. So these guys, they said, read the big book, and when you get done reading the big book, talk to me, and we'll do the steps. So that's what I did. I read the doctor's opinion in our big book, and I found out that I had a hopeless condition of mind and body, and I was doomed. And that's the thing that kind of opened up my mind to the second step was, you know, coming to terms with my condition, that I'm powerless over alcohol. So I got a sponsor, took the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the first 4 or 5 years, everything was kind of going okay. And I met her when I was about 8 months, 9 months sober. We stayed married for 5 years. And she decided to leave me for a newcomer one more time. I'm being left again, you know, and rejection, you know, and here comes all the old ideas. See, you're really not good enough, and you don't measure up. And I mean, it just all keeps coming back, man. It just never really goes away completely 100%. Maybe it's not supposed to, because if it ever went away, I wouldn't need God. I'd just be out there doing it all on my own. At that point in time in my sobriety, it's kind of like everything that I was talking about for the first 5 years, quoting pages, big book stuff, blah, 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 blah. Now it's going to be time. Now the time is going to come that you really believe everything you've been saying. Are you really for real? And I was. Because at 5 years sober, that was the hardest time of my life. I was a single parent for the next 10 years. I didn't think I was capable of doing that. And really, I wasn't. God gave me the power to do that every single day. Every single day. And, you know, so I had all these responsibilities raising a kid. I learned how to write a resentment list, you know, in my first couple of years of sobriety. And I would write these resentment lists and read it off to my sponsor, and I'd write all this inventory. And one day he asked me, he said, he got tired of hearing my crying and whining about, because I like to use people to justify my resentments, too. I don't know if anybody else ever does that. Because, again, I need to be right. And finally, one day, he got sick of hearing it, and he said, you know what the broken end of a Coke bottle looks like? I said, yeah. He says, can you see it laying down on the floor there? I'm just standing in front of him. Yeah. And of course, I'm thinking, what's the point here, a broken Coke bottle? He says, because every time we would get back and forth, it was always me making a decision based on self, based on my own selfishness, over and over and over. And it manifested itself with the idea that it's going to be different this time. And I really believed it. So he said to me, he said, every time you do that to yourself, visualize yourself picking up that Coke bottle and cutting your arm off on it. And then the guy actually said this, if that feels good, keep doing it. Then he walked off. just kind of left me standing there with all my own shit, man. If that feels good, keep doing it. And I finally realized right then and there that I need to talk to somebody else about this stuff. I can't deal with him anymore, you know, because, you know, I still need to be right, and in order to be right, I got to get you to get on board with me, and, you know, just the whole thing, you know, and God works in mysterious ways, and he did for me what I obviously couldn't do for myself one more time, and she moved to Hawaii, and it made things much better because I didn't have to see her anymore. And during that period of my sobriety, I was forced to learn something about meditation, and I didn't think that, first off, you know, I pray every day, even though it says soft through prayer and meditation, that and meditation part doesn't really apply to me, even though it says it there. And so out of a sense of pain and one more time being desperate and hopeless again, and I was forced to learn something about meditation, and I didn't think it would work for me. Because I'm of the belief that this isn't going to work for me, so why try? One more old idea. Why try? I can just stay a victim for the rest of my life about what she did to me. And, you know, victims don't stay sober, by the way. And so I learned something about meditation, and I read the 12 by 12, and I learned the St. Francis Prayer, and I've been using it ever since. And that St. Francis Prayer and learning something about that meditation really gave me the power not to, like, make the pain go away, but to feel the pain and be present and live with it until it left. And that's what happened, until it left. And, you know, so single parent and doing all that, and everything's going good and showing up for work, being a regular kind of guy, and my life is starting to come together like it never has before, and the quality of my life is improved so much. If I told you how good it really was, you'd think I was bragging. And so I'm just going on and just doing my own thing, going to meetings, and I was working with a lot of new people in AA, and I'm a firm believer, and when someone asks me to take them through the steps, I make time for them, and I take them through the steps out of the big book. I mean, that's just what I do, and it's a gift, because I get to spend time with the new person, and that's when I feel the most peace, for some reason. I mean, that's when I feel like I'm really contributing to AA, is when I'm spending time helping somebody or any kind of service work. And they told me, or I heard a long time ago, that's the highest rank you'll ever make in AA, is a servant. Doesn't matter where you come from, how long you've been. I mean, that's the highest status that I could ever hope to make, is a servant. And I believe that, because that's when it counts the most, is when it's really inconvenient. And it's been inconvenient lots of times, but I keep doing it. Because my sobriety, as I said, is a gift. And the way I show God gratitude for the gift he's given me is by helping others. Nice way to give back. And so, you know, I'm going through this stuff, and I got through this divorce, and everything's going good. Working, and finally, later on in my life, and Meredith shows up in my life, and I hadn't been really with anybody for 10 years. I mean, dating on and off and no real commitment at all for 10 years in the program of AA. And she came along in my life, and she came here from Hawaii to be a law student. And I met her and went out and dated, and we got married. And I've been married for 16 years to a wife to 17. I'm sorry for you. Thought it was 16. That's, you know, she's been with me by my side through thick and thin and everything that we've ever been through, just like Joey and a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, man. It's part of the gift of AA. And I've had my, you know, trials and tribulations and my ups and downs, and because I'm a human being. You know, I'm like present for life for the first time. I mean, I'm here for it, whatever it is. And I've had a lot, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, they talk about trudging the road to happy destiny. There's been times when I've had to trudge the road. You know, I mean, I've had losses in my life and sickness and health problems and all kinds of things. 1 minute left? Oh, okay. And, you know, I'll tell you, the thing that has saved my ass is working with other people and the people in AA. Because, see, the one thing that I couldn't do for a long, long time was, number one, trust anybody and allow myself to be vulnerable to anybody at all, because I was too afraid of what you might think of me because of my ego. And so my life has just been a gift, man. You know, so I get to the inventory and I write the inventory and 10 minutes. All right. And I see these defects of character, you know, the pride, the selfishness, and all this stuff. And so I get to the sixth step, and, you know, and I'm thinking, well, you know, all I have to do is just ask God to remove these things, and they'll just all be gone because I'm special. And I'm entitled, too, you know. And after all, I did all the work. I've got something coming. And it didn't quite work out that way. And I used to ask the guy that sponsored me for a long time, you know, why do I keep having this pride pop up on this inventory? Well, I mean, I keep praying and asking God to remove it, and he told me many, many times, he says, you better find a way to accept yourself as you are, with all your shortcomings and your pride and your defects of character and everything that is of you of being a human being. You better find a way to accept yourself as you are. And it finally penetrated through this thick skull of mine that I'm okay just who I am with all my defects of character. You know, they're never going to all go away. I think that they've been diminished, in my case, sufficiently enough to stay sober. I still have pride. I still have selfishness. I can still be, you know, like secretly dishonest, you know, like omitting truth and not telling the whole truth about things. I'm still self-seeking, especially even when I'm trying to be kind. I still always want something out of the deal. I'm still frightened. You know, I still have this stuff come up after being sober for a long time. And so... You know, what I found out about step six and seven is step six is, to me, it's like an unattainable goal that I'm never going to reach. Because that's really what it kind of implies, like absolute and total commitment towards moving towards perfection, which is an unattainable goal that I'm never going to achieve, but I always have to be looking in that direction. That's how I finally understand the sixth step. You know, I'm never going to achieve perfection with the removing of all my pride, but I always have to be looking in that direction. And I finally kind of got the message, like, that's what this thing's really all about, and reading steps 6 and 7 and the 12 by 12. And I asked a spiritual advisor one time about the seventh step, about that word humbly. I said, what do you think they mean by that word humbly up there? And he said, well, getting on your knees. I would have never thought of that. So when I do the seven-step prayer, that's how I do it. You know, I mean, I look at a defect of character, and the exact nature of the wrong is always some old idea that I'm not enough or I don't measure up. And the things that manifest from that is my selfishness and my manipulation. And I never knew any of that stuff for years. Get to step 8 and 9, I make my list, I go out and make amends. And there's one amends that I didn't want to make for 20 years in the program of AA. 20 years. And I had a guy tell me one time, because I was talking to him about this particular amends, and it's funny to me, well, it's not funny really, but the longer I get away from doing the next right thing, the easier it is to not do it. It's just unbelievable how the force and the powers of pride, because that's what it is. It's my pride. And I just found a way to kind of sneak it underneath the carpet and not really look at it too closely, you know, oh yeah, well, let's look over here. Whatever it was that I would do to not really want to face it. And this guy told me one time, he says, if it comes between you and drinking and making that amends, you'll make the amends. And I never forgot that. Bruce told me that. And so I don't know what it was. I think again, God works in mysterious ways, and I think he was trying to get my attention several years back, and I started thinking about this more than I ever had before, about making this amends. And I remember in the big book it says we agreed at the beginning, which is the third step, that we were willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. So I'm thinking, did I really make that decision in the third step, or am I just like a phony? And then I made the mistake of reading the big book where it talked about, you know, have you done your utmost to straighten out the past? And I said, I wonder what that word utmost means. So I made the mistake of looking at that. And I think that this is all God-inspired. I really do. So I got a dictionary. I looked up the word utmost, and it says extreme measures. And I had to say to myself, no, I haven't. Perhaps I haven't done the first step all the way. Because that's the evidence that I've done the first step all the way if I complete all the remaining steps. If I'm still being driven by my own first step experience, I'm going to do them all. I can't afford to do them halfway. So I didn't have a clue of how to approach this, and this is something that happened like 35, 40 years ago, and all I knew was this guy's name. So I get this grand idea because I have a big ego, and I want to look good all the time. I come up with this plan where I'm going to hire a private detective to track this guy down. So I did. I went to this guy and told him this guy's name. I said, I don't have a clue. He may not even be alive anymore. So he gave me all this information. I'm doing all the footwork, knocking on doors. Are you so-and-so? And I never did find a guy until one day he says, I think his ex-wife lives in La Jolla. And so I went out there, and she wasn't there, so I left a note. You know, I told her, I have a personal matter with your ex-husband. Will you please give him my phone number? So I just thought, well, you know, right there in step nine, you know, I've done my utmost. I've done everything I can do. Now I have to kind of put this in God's hands. I can't do any more. A week or two goes by, and my wife calls me. She says, you ought to listen to this message on the phone. It was that guy. He called me after 35, close to 40 years of talking to him. And I got home and it was him. And I called him up and told him what I did and told him I need to set this matter right. I need to start paying you back money. And he told me exactly what he wanted me to do. And again, having a big ego, I had to like do 10 times more than he wanted just to make sure that it was set right. And I'm free from that. I don't have to haunt myself with that anymore for the rest of my life, man. Absolutely freedom, you know. And I think step nine to me is probably the most freeing step there is. Like, how free do I want to be? Am I really willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, or am I just, like, talking about it, you know? And I really want to be sober, and I want to be free, and I want peace of mind, and I want happiness in my life. You know, I've got a really good life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my son went to Afghanistan, which was probably the hardest 10 months of my sobriety. And I wrote, I don't know how many fear lists in front of my sponsor and just bawled my eyes out because I'm not in control. I can't do anything about what's going on over there. And I just prayed and said, just dear God, just bring him home safe. I don't care about nothing else. And I meant it. And he came home safe, and, you know, he's got a job working for the Department of Defense. He's like a really nice little polite young man. I mean, I'm so proud of him, man. I mean, these are some of the gifts from sobriety, man, to be able to be part of his life and to watch him grow up. And from T-ball all the way through high school baseball, joining the Army, and you know, what a gift, man. Without Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God, it would not be possible, man. You know, I don't really have much else to say. You know, I want to welcome all the new people to AA. You know, it's here for you if you want sobriety. If you want to go to any lengths to get it, it's here. Anybody can do it. I mean, look at me. You know, Joe. I got a lot of people in AA that are real close to me that I think maybe the smarter you are, the worse it can be. You know, and so I came in here with an open mind and willing to do whatever these people told me to do so I can stay sober. I want to thank you guys for asking me to come up here and speak. It was an honor, man. It's an honor. I'm not a polished speaker, but that's my story. Thanks.